eyes of civilians.
A new selfie museum in Sweden is flipping the script by making visitors both the artist and the exhibit. The establishment is dubbed the Museum and is in a shopping mall in Stockholm. Unlike other selfie museums, this one has no works of art on its walls. Instead, its brightly decorated rooms are meant to serve as fun backgrounds for visitors to take their selfies or shoot videos in. Other rooms let the visitors bury themselves in candy-colored foam bricks, strike a pose under neon lights, or sit on a huge, colorful swing. The manager says the museum is interactive and lets the visitors be the artists themselves in order to create the art they want to see. The Drone Show Korea 2022 has been held at the Busan Exhibition and Convention Center, BEXCO. It featured 137 companies and 533 booths, making this year's incarnation the largest in the show's six-year history. The event also featured the participation of a large international industry representatives from Japan and Western Europe. A highlight of this year's event was military technology centered around the unveiling of new indigenous UAVs. This year's show marked a long-endurance liquid hydrogen drone produced by a South Korean company. These developments reflect South Korea's attempt to improve resilience and revolutionize its approach to warfare. The event puts on display the importance of drone industry in various spheres, including defense purposes. More than 163 wildlife species have been released back into lagoons and forests in Colombia's Casanare province after being seized and rehabilitated by authorities fighting wildlife trafficking. These include 15 different species such as anteaters, turtles, macaws, a toucan, and a leopard. They were nurtured back to health by fauna vets from an environmental authority in charge of managing sustainable development. The authority, Corporinoquia, released more than 1,200 animals back into the wild in 2021 alone. Colombia is one of the world's most biodiverse countries by square kilometer and is home to some 10% of the world's flora and fauna.
A super rare birth has added a cute member to critically endangered Sumatran rhinos of Indonesia. The newborn calf is the sixth born since intensive efforts to breed the species began in the 1980s. The female calf, which doesn't have a name yet, was given birth to by a rhino named Rosa in a sanctuary. Rosa has suffered 8 miscarriages since 2005 when she was brought in from the wild for a breeding program. Fewer than 80 Sumatran rhinos remain in the world, mainly on the Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo. Excessive poaching along with other threats has brought the species to the brink of extinction.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
in the limelight.
The real threat against the U.S. is that of detached politicians who are amassing wealth, fighting for power and prestige, while their countrymen and women continue to go hungry, says Ramzi Baruth, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Biden's real challenge is not Russia or China, but poverty in America. Here's the story. Mainstream U.S. media continues to celebrate the supposed strength of the U.S. economy. Almost daily, headlines speak of hopeful numbers, sustainable growth, positive trends, and constant gains. The reality on the ground, however, tells of something entirely different, which raises the question, are Americans being lied to, and for what purpose? U.S. economy grew 1.7% in fourth quarter, capping a strong year, the New York Times reported. U.S. economy grew 5.7% in 2021, fastest full-year clip, the Washington Post added. Reuters, Voice of America, the Financial Times, CNN, MarketWatch, and many others all concurred. But if that is the case, why then is U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating at an all-time low? And why are many Americans literally going hungry? In a national opinion poll conducted by Reuters Ipsos and published on February 3rd, only 41% of U.S. adults approved of Biden's performance in office. A whopping 56% disapproved. The numbers were not a complete shock, as the downward trajectory of the Biden presidency has been in effect soon after he moved to the White House over a year ago. The truth is, Biden was not the Democrats' top choice nominee for president. Judging by various opinion polls and the early results of the Democratic primaries in 2020, it was Bernie Sanders who represented the Democratic hope for real, substantive change. Party politics, liberal media insistence that Sanders was not electable, and fear-mongering regarding a second Trump term in office pushed Biden through the ranks of nominees to be presented as America's only hope for salvation. While Republicans remain committed to the Donald Trump's legacy and are still largely politically and ideologically united, Democrats are growingly unconfident in their leadership and uncertain regarding the future of their democracy, governance, and economy. Of course, they are blameless in holding such views. While the Democratic leadership continues to obsess with its fear of Trump, and while liberal media insists that the U.S. economy is as healthy as it can be, the average American continues to struggle against encroaching poverty, inflation, and lack of future prospects. Here are some of sobering numbers. 56% of all Americans cannot produce a meager $1,000 as an emergency expense from their existing savings, CNBC reported. 1 in 10 U.S. adults have gone hungry last December as a result of poverty, Forbes.com reported. Columbia University Center on Poverty and Social Policy revealed that child poverty rate in the United States stands at 17%, one of the highest among developed countries. If American workers are studied separately from the larger population, the numbers are even more grim. 3/4 of American workers said that it was very or somewhat difficult to make ends meet, according to a study conducted by Shift Project and reported in NBC News Online. 40% of the polled workers said they're not able to come up with $400 in emergency money. But the most shocking of all, according to the same study, is that around 20% said they went hungry because they shouldn't and couldn't afford enough to eat. Aside from occasional government handouts, which were provided by both the Trump and Biden administrations, little has been done by way of structural changes to the U.S. economy that would ensure greater equality among all sectors of society. Instead, the administration's priorities seem to be allocated to something else entirely. Writing in Politico, David Siders describes the current political discourse within Democratic Party circles where Democrats are losing their minds over 2024. Since the Democratic president's public approval ratings are dismal, Democrats fear the return of Trump. All anyone can talk about is Trump, donors, policy folks, party insiders, and the media. Siders quoted a Democratic advisor as saying the same advisor described a weird cycle where the conversation keeps coming back to Trump. Whether conscious of this obsession or not, the Biden administration seems to operate entirely according to a political strategy that is predicted on tarnishing Trump and his supporters, retelling over and over again the story of the January 6th insurrection, hoping for a Republican split or any other miracle that would bolster their chances of maintaining their congressional majority in the next November amid term elections. While doing so, the Democratic leadership seems oblivious to the harsh reality on the ground, where food prices are skyrocketing and where inflation has reached unbearable levels. According to new data released on February 10th by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. Consumer Price Index, CPI, rose by 7.5% in January compared to the same month a year ago, making it the fastest annual pace since 1982, the Financial Times reported. The rise in inflation is not a one-time-off event, as CPI has been rising at a sustainable level of 0.6% on a monthly basis. Ordinary people can feel this increase almost every time they go shopping. Small business owners, especially restaurants, bakeries, and grocery stores, are left with one out of two options, either increasing their prices or shutting down completely. Consequently, large segments of the already vulnerable U.S. population are growing more desperate than ever. To avoid providing real answers to difficult questions about the welfare of millions of Americans, about the real function of their democratic institutions, and about existing corruption within the U.S. political system, regardless of who controls the Congress or resides in the White House, Democrats and their media are either blaming their Republican rivals or creating foreign policy distractions.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The ongoing crisis in Ukraine has revealed the ugly face of Europe. It showed blatant racism against African, Arab, and Indian immigrants, despite all the human rights slogans adopted by European countries. Now, here is one shocking clip of African students who were denied the right to escape crisis-ridden Ukraine. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on racial discrimination of Africans fleeing Ukraine. The world was shocked, but not surprised, by high levels of flagrant racism perpetrated against the people of color in Europe. In the second part of our program, still on the issue of racism by Western imperialist powers, we are talking about the horrific transatlantic slave trade and asking, has slavery ended or does it still continue to devastate the people of Africa? Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Ukraine crisis exposes Europe's racism. The world has witnessed dehumanizing treatment against international students from Africa, South Asia, and the West Asia in Ukraine. Many Africans fleeing Ukraine and other wars and conflicts around the world have not received the same treatment as Ukrainian refugees. While white women and children were given priority on vehicles departing the country, African women were barred from trains leaving Kiev, even though there were empty seats.
A Nigerian student fleeing Ukraine gives an account of some of the incidents of racial discrimination they endured. Let's take a listen.
I started running from 25th of last month. Crossing the foreign border to Poland was devastating because of the discrimination. The first discrimination was at Kyiv train station. They were allowing, they said, only women and children. I said, okay, that's fine. But I don't see you taking the other African women and the other Middle Eastern women that are pregnant. And they were actually in the cold, some with their kids.
Now, for more on the horrific scenes of racial discrimination against Africans in Ukraine and other parts of Europe, we contacted Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Now, our first question to you, to what extent has the crisis in Ukraine exposed the evil of racism, which Europe has been trying for a long time to disguise?
I think it exposed the racial discrimination a lot for those of us who understand the geopolitical context and that NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is the primary contradiction in this issue. Everything leading up to that is because of that, and a NATO being a military alliance of the Western European nations and their contradictory or double standard way of dealing with other countries in the world.
African students in Ukraine did not just face racial discrimination, but there were also disturbing reports of many being forced to join the country's military forces. Ukraine's president has been appealing to people of goodwill worldwide to support his country amid the blatant acts of racial discrimination against non-white immigrants, particularly blacks and Arabs in his country.
It's a proxy state. The government is, and proxy states expect returns for their service of being a proxy. So when he makes these appeals, he's also expecting the backing and the support of, which we've seen with United States and other Western nations also inducing their populations and inducing as much as they can around the world to respond to these appeals.
The Ukrainian crisis has revealed deep-rooted racism in Western media's coverage of the conflict. Now, Western media outlets are under fire for the evidently racist undertones in their coverage of the unfolding humanitarian crisis. Now, these mainstream Western media outlets have amplified empathy for Europeans while normalizing the suffering of war and disaster in other regions of the world, such as Africa, West Asia, and Afghanistan.
Now the unthinkable has happened to them. And this is not a developing third world nation. This is Europe.
These are not refugees from Syria. These are refugees from neighboring Ukraine. I mean, that, quite frankly, is part of it. These are...
What does this level of bias and outright racism say about mainstream Western media outlets?
Western media are basically cheerleaders for imperialism. They portray conflicts in various places based on a reflection of what it means and for the interest of imperialism. Most of the conflicts in the world, most of them by and large, are instigated and supported and carried out by imperialism, even if it's through proxies or whatever. But they're for the ability, the imperialism requires the destabilization of various places so that the people in large, in mass, can't exercise self-determination and what happens with the resources of their country, the mineral resources, what happens with labor rights, all those type of things. And so when the media is reporting on places like, for example, what's happening with Ukraine, right, they're usually not reporting on a war or an atrocity that involves the opposition or the competition, so to speak, with the enemies of imperialism. They're usually reporting on imperialist wars and imperialist instigated wars, no matter how imperialism wants to characterize them. And so they report them the way imperialism wants them characterized. Here, it's in the interest of imperialism to report the most, you know, one-sided and diabolical, you know, intent in terms of this war, because this is their adversary.
African countries condemned the mistreatment of African nationals trying to flee Ukraine during a special session of the United Nations General Assembly early March. Speaking during the session, Matho Joini, South Africa's ambassador to the UN, said her country joins other African countries in condemning the discrimination of Africans in Europe.
South Africa endorses the statement issued by the African Union Commission, expressing concern that the treatment given to African nationals and people of African descent at the borders of Ukraine, some of whom are not allowed to cross and move to safety. We urge European countries to take steps to resolve this situation, as all people have a right to cross international borders during times of conflict.
Have African countries reacted strongly enough to the acts of racism being perpetrated against their citizens in Ukraine and neighboring European countries?
I tend to think we want to make a distinction with the question, that we want to make a distinction when we say African countries between the leadership of the countries, and particularly we're talking about largely neocolonial states that are just having to be subservient to international finance capital, have all the trappings of independence, but they really are governed and manipulated by outside. And then there's the masses of the people on the ground who have a different reaction and who really, you know, are expressing whatever they get. So we have to make that distinction. On the ground, we have people who demonstrated about, you know, against these types of things and demonstrating in a lot of ways in for different aspects against this war that's taking place.
African students formally appeared to be welcome into Ukraine and injected millions of dollars into the country's economy, but have now realized that they were truly not perceived as equal, but inferior by whites in this country. Now, Mr. Freeman, what lessons can Africans learn from this form of racism?
I think the lesson in it is that white supremacy is a global phenomenon, and it is also about power, and that we have to fight for power in this world, the power dispositions regarding the economic dispositions and political dispositions, how much we can control our own, you know, we have self-determination. That's what we have to fight for, and we have to do it in a mass, and we have to realize that we're in a global struggle against white supremacy and international finance capital, against the rest of collective humanity.
The International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination is observed annually on 21st of March. Despite such a day being marked globally, we are still witness to shocking incidents of racial discrimination.
Now, our last question to you, Mr. Freeman, is the so-called international community paying lip service to the struggle against racism?
I think it's very interesting in the sense that even as the question is posed, there's a sort of an underlining acknowledgement that when we say international community, we're really talking about the Western countries, Western leadership, you know, Western European countries, rather. And so the international community has to come to be redefined. It's going to be only paying lip service to these things because the Western world's preeminence and its supremacy in the world is dependent on racial discrimination and those type of things. So it can only pay lip service to it. And so we have to come to redefine what international community means in a way so that it doesn't refer to the Western European elite and that it becomes redefined through a people-centered process and struggle for self-determination and for socialism. And so we have to have that.
Now, that's an interesting perspective indeed. We need to redefine what really comprises of the international community. Thanks a lot, Mr. Freeman, for your incisive analysis. And I'll take a short break. When we come back, we shall be talking about the transatlantic slave trade. Stay with us.
Remembering slavery.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
For over 400 years, nearly 20 million men, women, and children from Africa were the victims of the tragic transatlantic slave trade, one of the darkest chapters in human history. Now, this criminal trade was officially carried out by European colonial powers. In commemoration of the memory of the victims, the General Assembly of the United Nations on the 17th December 2007 declared the 25th of March as the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade, to be observed annually.
The resolution also called for the establishment of a program to mobilize educational institutions, civil society, and other organizations to inculcate in future generations the causes, consequences, and lessons of the transatlantic slave trade, and to communicate the dangers of racism and prejudice. This year, the President of the United Nations General Assembly, Abdullah Shahid, visited the Ark of Return, the United Nations permanent memorial to honor the victims of slavery and the transatlantic slave trade.
Now, during his visit to this memorial site, which also stands testimony as a reminder that racism has no place in the world, he recalled his visit to Senegal's Gori Island.
Years ago, I visited Gori Island in Senegal, which was the largest slave trading center on the African coast from the 15th to the 19th century. I saw the small spaces, imagining the crowded rooms where the enslaved persons were packed. I will never forget the feeling of sorrow and distress, thinking on those who went through the very small door overlooking the Atlantic Ocean.
Now, for more on the remembrance of the inhuman transatlantic slave trade perpetrated by Western colonial powers, we contacted PLO Lumumba, a renowned Pan-Africanist and academic. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Now, our first question, do you think the transatlantic slave trade is given the attention it deserves in Africa and the Americas?
I don't think so. I think whatever attention we give it is merely salutary. One would have expected that an event as devastating as it was is given attention which is continental one would have expected that there is a day that is dedicated in all African countries to remember that unfortunate raid. But that does not happen. In fact, one can say that the commemoration is left to a few public-spirited individuals, and it barely gets mentioned in many African countries, which is tragic in itself.
The British royal couple visited Jamaica from March 22 to 24 this year in order to commemorate Queen Elizabeth's Platinum Jubilee. This was just before the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade. The visit was met by protests from Jamaicans demanding an apology and reparations from Britain over its leading role in slave trade.
To us, for these young people to be here to try to persuade us to keep the status quo in place when our goal is to loosen and remove the hands, the gloved hands of the Queen from around our necks so that we can breathe.
Mr. Lumumba, what's your take on this visit, especially considering that Britain's royal family was deeply involved in colonialism and the slave trade?
Remember that the British monarch, particularly the current monarch, was present when colonialism was alive and well. And it saddens me that she is given the accolades which she does not deserve, by those whose parents and those whose ancestors were traumatized and victimized by slavery. It is a case of selective amnesia on both sides. The monarch pretends that there was no slavery, the monarch pretends that there was no colonization, and the people also behave as if there was no slavery and no colonization. I think we should speak unanimously and tell the monarch that until there is an unequivocal apology from the British government, they will never be given the accolade that they so much crave for.
While slave trade helped turn America and Western European countries into economic giants they are today, many like these Jamaicans here protesting a visit by members of Britain's royal family are demanding an apology and reparations.
Respect us, man. Apologize now.
Sending a shout out to the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and the entire royal family that reparation time come now.
Isn't it about time that European countries involved in the evil slave trade apologize and pay reparations to Africa, just like they are doing to alleged victims of Holocaust?
Without doubt, you'd have seen in my previous answer, I've talked about slavery as if it were colonization, because in my view, colonization is slavery turned inside out. And in direct answer to your question, I'm saying that we deserve reparations. We don't ask for it. We don't act as a team as Africans. We are still victims of divide and rule. Your typical African leader, still, if they were colonized by the British or by the French or the Portuguese or the Germans or the Italians, still behave as if they are beholden to those countries. And that is why we can't speak with one voice.
Despite the so-called abolition of slavery in the United States, African Americans continue to suffer institutional racism, and the brutal murder of George Floyd is just an example of what people of African descent endure every day in America. Clearly, racism still lingers in the United States.
George Floyd is simply emblematic of what happens on a daily basis, and I think that it is incumbent upon us to keep speaking about and against it, because if we don't, it will continue to gain roots in subterranean and subtle ways.
The only known existing autobiography of an African slave in America was written in Arabic by Omar ibn Said,
This autobiography debunked myths that enslaved Africans had no culture or civilization. How does the story of Omar bin Said tell us about the distortion of the history of African Americans?
The history of Africa has always been distorted, and if you want to see the dramatization of this unfortunate situation, Alex Haley's Roots dramatizes the modus operandi of the slave master. First of all, they took away your language, they dehumanized you, they humiliated you, they erased your history, and they claim that your life only started when you are enslaved. You did not know how to write, you did not think, you are simply one who had a human form, but you are not a human being, you are not a thinking being. And that continues to be perpetuated even today. And the time has come for Africans to begin to ask certain fundamental questions. Why is it that they destroyed the museums which were found in different parts of Africa? Why is it that they erased our history? And we too have an obligation to make it known to the world that we had a history.
Over the recent past, there have been reports of continued slavery in different parts of the world. Now, Mr. Lumumba, can you elaborate on this phenomenon?
You know, in my view, slavery has always metamorphosized. When the Western world recognized that slavery was no longer sustainable, it went into the next stage, which was colonization. And when colonization was no longer tenable and sustainable, it has transformed into the neocolonial project. And that is not to say that classical slavery has ended. We know that slavery is going on in different parts of the world, in the Sahelian region, slavery is alive and well. In different parts of Europe, slavery is still alive and well. But latter-day slavery is of an economic kind. We are so beholden to the erstwhile colonizer, the erstwhile slave master, and we do not know, and even if we do not know, we are not conscious of its very pervasive character. Today, the African economies are simply marionettes controlled from European capitals, which can be switched off without a notice.
Okay, Mr. Lumumba, our final question to you. What needs to be done to eliminate or eradicate these forms of economic slavery you just talked about?
African countries should work as a team, and there have been efforts in that direction, beginning with the Lagos Plan of Action of 1980. I now see the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. That is an initiative which should address the economic slavery and colonization that we still labor under. It is also important that Africans remove tariff and non-tariff barriers and allow their citizens to move across the continent without these impediments.
Thank you very much, Mr. PLO Lumumba, for your insight. Now, as our guest said, the African countries need to emancipate themselves from economic slavery that continues to be perpetrated by Western imperialist powers. And that brings us to the end of Vietnamite edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
New research has prompted warnings that humanity is financing its own extinction through subsidies damaging to the climate and wildlife. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Patrick Greenfield. The piece is titled, "World Spends $1.8 Trillion a Year on Subsidies That Harm Environment," study finds. The world is spending at least $1.8 trillion every year on subsidies, driving the annihilation of wildlife and a rise in global heating, according to a new study, prompting warnings that humanity is financing its own extinction. From tax breaks for beef production in the Amazon jungle to financial support for unsustainable groundwater pumping in the Middle East, billions of pounds of government spending and other subsidies are harming the environment, says the first cross-sector assessment for more than a decade. This government support, equivalent to 2% of global gross domestic product or GDP, is directly working against the goals of the Paris Climate Accord and draft targets on reversing biodiversity loss, the research on explicit subsidies found, effectively financing water pollution, land subsidence, and deforestation with state money. The authors of the new report, who are leading subsidies experts, say a significant portion of the $1.8 trillion could be repurposed to support policies that are beneficial for nature and a transition to net zero emissions, amid growing political division about the cost of decarbonizing the global economy. The new report calls for governments to agree a target to eradicate environmentally harmful subsidies by the end of the decade at the biodiversity COP15 gathering in China later on this year, where it is hoped a Paris Agreement for Nature will be signed, and for companies to reveal the subsidies they receive as part of environmental disclosure reporting. Cristiana Figueres, who was head of the United Nations Climate Change Convention when the Paris Climate Accord was signed, welcomed the new research. She said the subsidies were creating huge risks for the businesses receiving them. "Nature is declining at an alarming rate, and we have never lived on a planet with so little biodiversity," Cristiana Figueres said. She added, "Harmful subsidies must be redirected towards protecting the climate and nature, rather than financing our own extinction." The fossil fuel industry, with $620 billion, the agricultural sector, with $520 billion, the water industry, with $320 billion, and forestry, with $155 billion, account for the majority of the $1.8 trillion, according to the new report. No estimate for mining, believed to cause billions of dollars worth of damage to ecosystems every year, could be derived. Lack of transparency between governments and recipients means the true figure is likely to be much higher, as is the implicit cost of harmful subsidies. Last year, an International Monetary Fund report found the fossil fuel industry benefited from subsidies worth $5.9 trillion in 2020. But the vast majority of this figure comes from the hidden costs of failing to make polluters pay for the deaths that they cause and for global heating. Douglas Koplow, founder of the organization EarthTrack, which monitors environmentally harmful subsidies, and a co-author of the new report, along with Ronald Steenblick, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development's former special counselor for fossil fuel and subsidy reform, said, "Subsidy reform allows us to improve the price signal so that we're not protecting income in more polluting industries. It creates space for alternative and cleaner forms of energy to enter the marketplace." A draft target in the United Nations Biodiversity Agreement for this decade calls for $500 billion a year in subsidies to be reformed. But the B Team and Business for Nature, which supported the new research, have said this must be strengthened. The world has never met a target on halting biodiversity loss, and the failure to act on subsidies was highlighted as a major issue from last decade's targets. Eva Zabi, Executive Director of Business for Nature, said businesses were often unaware of the extent of explicit and implicit subsidies that they benefited from, but could use their influence to call for change. Eva Zabi added, "Many businesses are benefiting from these environmentally harmful subsidies. This cannot be a taboo topic. We need to speak using facts and understand where the financial flows are going." She added, "Typically, the subsidies were established with good intentions in mind. We need to level the playing field because right now, some are benefiting from a head start when it should be the other way round. It's a wicked problem." Last year, a United Nations report found almost 90% of subsidies given to farmers every year are harmful, damaging people's health, fueling the climate crisis, destroying nature, and driving inequality by excluding smallholder farmers. Elizabeth Marema, the United Nations biodiversity head, said the new report was critically important. Elizabeth Marema added, "The report highlights how redirecting, repurposing, or eliminating subsidies could make an important contribution to unlocking the $711 billion required each year to halt and reverse the loss of nature by 2030, as well as the cost of reaching net zero carbon emissions," she added. The world has failed to meet a single target to stem the destruction of wildlife and life-sustaining ecosystems in the last decade, according to a devastating new report from the United Nations on the state of nature. From tackling pollution to protecting coral reefs, the international community did not fully achieve any of the 20 Aichi biodiversity targets agreed in Japan in 2010 to slow the loss of the natural world. It is the second consecutive decade that governments have failed to meet their targets. The Global Biodiversity Outlook 5, published before a key United Nations summit on the issue later this month, found that despite progress in some areas, natural habitats have continued to disappear. Vast numbers of species remain threatened by extinction from human activities, and $500 billion of environmentally damaging government subsidies have not been eliminated. Six targets have been partially achieved, including those on protected areas and invasive species. While governments did not manage to protect 17% of terrestrial and inland water areas and 10% of marine habitats, 44% of vital biodiverse areas are now under protection, an increase from 29% back in 2000. About 200 successful eradications of invasive species on islands have also taken place. The United Nations said the natural world was deteriorating and failure to act could undermine the goals of the Paris Agreement on the climate crisis and the Sustainable Development Goals. The head of the United Nations Biodiversity, Elizabeth Marema, said humanity was at a crossroads that would decide how future generations experience the natural world. Elizabeth Marema added, "Earth's living systems as a whole are being compromised, and the more humanity exploits nature in unsustainable ways and undermines its contributions to people, the more we undermine our own well-being, our own security and prosperity," she added.
A quarter century after the fall of the Iron Curtain, never have there been so many politically driven walls in our world. Dividing communities, separating the rich from the poor, and marking borders, walls have become the preferred solution for resolving major conflicts. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. This week's documentary explores how the business of constructing barriers is pursued with ever greater physical, financial, and ideological vigor in the 21st century. From the Middle East to the wealthiest societies of the West, municipal, regional, and international walls have become the preferred means of resolving conflicts and addressing or avoiding civil unrest. Stay with us as we investigate the geopolitics of urban and cultural segregation as seen in Iraq, Brazil, and France.
Just imagine that tomorrow we were to live in private villages behind high security fences. The Mireille neighborhood in Toulouse. 35,000 people live here. From the outside, it's considered a volatile ghetto. The Mirai is dogged by high unemployment and boredom. At night, as a distraction, youngsters noisily rev their engines. This is a public area. Only one association is trying to maintain some sort of law and order, a local group called the Mediators.
Don't hang about here, right under the buildings. Go home. Look at the time. People are asleep now.
Okay, we'll go. Actually, until the Mediators tell us to go home, we hang around outside. Do the residents ever call the police to say they can't stand the bloody noise anymore? Yeah, it can happen. It happens often. They call the police, yeah, sure. We know that because they see that the police won't intervene, so they ask us to help. We get involved, but as you saw, they're on public property. And we can talk to them. Tell them to put their motorbikes away. If they listen, all the better. The police never come here for that sort of thing. Well, if they do, it would be a game of cat and mouse, you know what I mean? In this kind of social housing, they now take care of their own security. They've learned to live without the police. That doesn't bother you? No, it's okay. I've never been scared. She's been here since 1975. I mean, sometimes I go out. I come back at 4 or 5 in the morning. Used to come home and I never had any problems. That means there's a... What about the police? Do they ever come here when you call them? The police? I don't know. I really don't know. But I think it would be worse if they did come. Zubir Sadi was born here, grew up here, and has witnessed the neighborhood slowly change.
Yeah.
They've only just got their license as well. I've looked after him for a while now. All he did was stupid things. I saw the mix of people who used to live here. There were whites, Europeans, all sorts of backgrounds. I used to see my parents. They'd go and visit the neighbors. All sorts of different mixes of people. But slowly people began to leave. And we were lucky, because we experienced that kind of diversity. These youngsters don't know that. I was scared, to be honest. There was always so much noise. I saw cars set on fire. But unfortunately, the police would never come, because they'd get attacked. So you felt the estate was left to fend for itself. Yeah, that's right. We'll turn over here. Paulette is one of the middle-class residents that has fled the social housing estates. There, that's it. That last building down there. I used to live there, up on the sixth floor. Do you ever come back?
No.
No. I never wanted to come back. And I never have. Why not? I don't feel comfortable. You see, where I live now, there are just two floors. Here, there can be as many as 15 floors. It's like cages for hens. Paulette moved to a nearby protected estate. There are more of them in Toulouse than anywhere else in France. She now feels much better. We all know each other. We're safe. We can leave the door open. No one can come in. There are no problems. We're not scared of anything. Here we go, this way. Enclosed residences are not necessarily ghettos for the rich. Paulette is a civil servant. That's nice, isn't it? She has a modest salary and a 45 square meter apartment like all those who live here. With her neighbours, Paulette has rediscovered some of the warmth of the poorer areas. I've got just about everybody's spare set of keys because some of my neighbours are a bit scatty, so you never know. It's very friendly here in this residence. I think it's very pleasant to be here. We're not far from town, and it's a bit like being in the countryside. It's quiet, you can walk around. And there's a pool. It's like a holiday camp. But here, the rules are strict. Even too strict, says Christine, a resident. They've been sending out non-stop things, you know, like notices telling people how to behave, not to make too much noise. I think it's, well, yeah, the rules are a bit strict sometimes. I mean, to ask children not to shout outside when they need to shout, kids shout. If I hear a kid laughing, I don't think it's a nuisance. That's all. You know, I'm fairly moderate. I don't know. I think it's a bit much. Well, it's not the kids for me, it's the adults. The ones who don't show respect for others, to be honest. There was one person here who wasn't very nice. He made a lot of mistakes. Well, he made noise once or twice. No, he was noisy. I mean, I couldn't sleep once. But my neighbor's camera picked him up. In this small paradise, if you make too much noise, the various security devices will hear you. We're undergoing an urban segregation in this country. Some have recently suggested using the term fragmentation to describe this new kind of town made up of separate parts that have increasingly less in common with each other. So it really marks the end of a kind of society. Yes, it could well be the end of a certain type of society, or in fact a new multi-speed society, a club society, in which the public good is considered like a club. If you can afford it, you pay for membership of the club and benefit from the goods